Welcome to this week's episode. I am your host, Dr. Jessica Hochman. Today, I'll be joined by Dr. Andrew Friedman. He's the director of pediatric urology at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. So for a bit of background, when I was a resident in pediatrics, I spent a couple of weeks doing a rotation with Dr. Friedman. And I remember it was a really interesting experience for me because I learned how common peeing and pooping issues are for children. So even though Dr. Friedman is a surgeon, much of his time is actually spent counseling families about common pediatric conditions like constipation, potty training, and nighttime wetting. I know you'll learn a lot from Dr. Friedman. We talk about all of these issues in great depth. He's a great resource, a talented doctor, and he has a very reassuring way about him. I hope you'll enjoy. Hi, welcome to this week's episode of Ask Dr. Jessica. I'm really excited. We have a phenomenal guest today, Dr. Andrew Friedman. I've known Dr. Friedman. I did a rotation with you. It's well over a decade ago now, actually.
Wow.
And I still think to this day and repeat and quote you with a lot of patients about various pediatric urologic issues. So I'm really excited to be able to ask you questions today. So
I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. So first, Dr. Friedman is a pediatric urologist. He works at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, which is a very well-known hospital in the Los Angeles area, and he's the director of pediatric urology. So maybe we can start by asking you, what is a pediatric urologist, and how did you get to this place? Like, what drew you to pediatric urology?
Oh, terrific. So pediatric urology are urologists first, who then go on and get additional training to focus on children. There's about 350 pediatric urologists in the United States, and it's a two-year additional years of training. I think what separates pediatric urologists is its focus is much more on reconstruction. Much of what we do from the surgical standpoint is reconstructive surgery, as opposed to adult urology, which is a lot of cancer and extirpative and removing things. Pediatric urologists like to build things and like to put things back together. So a lot of what we deal with is congenital anomalies of the urinary tract. So when we talk about urology, a lot of times people don't really realize what urology is. Urology is the specialty that is responsible as surgeons for the urinary tract, meaning the kidneys, ureter, bladder, urethra, as well as the male reproductive organs. We take care of the things related to the testicles or the penis. And for pediatric urology, mostly deal with children who have congenital anomalies of those organs, either obstructions or where the things are just not in the right position, or they weren't formed correctly, and we try to put those things back together. And the nice thing in urology is almost everything we deal with, we can fix it, rebuild it, replace it, make it work.
So amazing.
It's a fun field.
Wow, that's such a wide variety of issues that you take care of.
That's what really makes it fun. So in the office, one patient will be a kidney issue, one will be a bladder issue, one will be a penis issue, and we go round and round. So it does make it really interesting, and it's a really wide variety.
So within that wide variety, what would you say are the most common issues that you take care of?
So I would sort of break them up by age. So okay. Probably about half the kids we see are infants. And most of the things we see with infants are where their kidneys are dilated, or they can have hydronephrosis. They can have an obstruction.
Okay.
They can have reflux, where the urine in the bladder goes back up to the kidneys, or they can just be something that just takes time to work itself out and improve on its own. But about 2-4% of pregnancies, when they have their prenatal ultrasound, the family's told the kidneys are dilated. So we work with those families. A lot of what we do is working with little boys whose testicles didn't come down.
Okay.
In fact, 3% of newborns will have a testicle that didn't come down. And about 2/3 of them will get better, but the other third will need to do an operation to bring it down. And then we do things like hernias, or what we call hydrocephalus, fluid around the testicle. So we do a lot of times with infants. And of course, our favorite thing is pediatric urology, something called hypospadias. So hypospadias is an underdevelopment of the urethra. If you think of the urethra as like a tube that sort of zips up from the bottom and their zipper got stuck, well, the penis is sort of bent downward and the opening's below the head. And that's the favorite thing for pediatric urologists, is to fix that and make the penis look right. For children, we deal with a lot of issues with peeing and pooping. So a lot of my day is talking to kids about their peeing and pooping. And that's because they're getting infections, they're wetting their pants, they're wetting the bed. That's a lot of our day. And then we even see adolescents who have problems with the dilated veins around their testicles, or pain in the testicles, or peeing and pooping issues as well. So a lot of our day is talking about peeing and pooping.
We have that in common.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I like what you said about how a lot of these things that are in infancy seem to get better with time. I think that's such a good thing to hear, because this comes up a lot, like that hydronephrosis comment you made about how in pregnancy, women will be pregnant and they'll find out that their child has this diagnosis called hydronephrosis, and it leaves moms really nervous while they're pregnant. Just to touch on that a little bit, what do you usually see as the outcome? Do most babies, does it resolve over time? Is it something that you have to intervene with?
Yeah. So what we tell families when we see them, and we oftentimes talk to pregnant women prior to delivery so that they can be prepared for how we're going to deal with this afterwards. We tell the families half the kids will get better before they're born. Of the other half, 80% get better on their own in the first 3 years of life. Now, there are some that are really severe and they are obstructed, and then we can fix them, and we fix them between 2 or 3 months of age. And the nice thing is those kidneys can be salvaged, as opposed to finding them the way we used to find them when they were 6 years old or 10 years old or 15 years old, and 40% of those kidneys were shot and had to, you know, were taken out. And then we also find kids who have reflux, high-grade reflux, and we can treat them and prevent them from showing up with infections and scarring in their kidney or hypertension. So it's great that we're finding it, but people have to understand there's a difference between perfect and normal, right? So the perinatologist, they want everything to be perfect. If it's not perfect, they get nervous and they want to tell you about it. We just want kids to be normal. Right. So we realize that a lot of these just are ultrasound findings. And then if you wait them out, they get better on their own. And it doesn't mean they don't need to be evaluated and managed. But for the most part, the vast majority of them will get better on their own. And those that have an issue, they can be fixed and fixed early on and protect the function of that kidney. But I would tell people that even if they find it after birth, 80% of those are going to get better in the first 3 years of life.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I think in particular, that's the most common prenatal ultrasound. That's the most common abnormal ultrasound finding that I hear about from parents. So I'm really happy to hear you say that most do get better on their own. Now let's talk about the peeing and pooping. So what is the most common peeing question that comes up? Let's say in toddlerhood, is it about bedwetting? What comes up as a common question for you?
So we need to think about is most of the toddlers are still pre-toilet trained. So it's really a little bit older children. It's really more the school age children.
When they come to see and you.
When they come to see us for the peeing and pooping. Because otherwise, pre-toilet training, it's not really an issue. And then, the kids struggle through toilet training at anywhere from, 2 to 3 years of age. Average age for boys now is probably about 3, 3.5. Girls about 2.5, 3. And then where sort of the rubber hits the road when they start getting to school, is when you start wetting your pants at school. So the most common things that for us is either recurrent infections or wetting, or what I like to refer to as they're doing some behavior that the parents are not happy with. They're constantly grabbing their penis. They're constantly touching their vagina. They are, running around squatting. And oftentimes people don't recognize what that behavior is representative of. Or the girls complain of vaginal pain. So we see lots and lots of girls who are complaining of vaginal pain, and they're getting all kinds of treatments for the vagina. They're getting, antifungals and antibiotics, steroid cream. And really it's their peeing and pooping is the issue. And the main thing is when we say peeing and pooping, we mean those things together, because there's a significant connection between peeing and pooping in that they share the same pelvic floor. So people tend to differentiate we'll talk to the urologist about the peeing, but we'll talk to the GI doctor about the pooping.
Right.
But no, we need to talk about those things together, because it's the same pelvic floor muscles. And so if you're constipated, then it's very hard and you're tightening up to hold that big poop in, you can't relax to pee, right? And your brain can't always tell which one feels full, because there's a lot of crosstalk between the two, as well as you feel pressure against your pelvic floor, but you don't know if it's that you need to pee or you need to poop. And they'll tend to hold one. So those two things have to be looked at holistically. So it's not enough just to take care of one. We have to really address both at the same time. And admittedly, I think all children are constipated.
Really?
I mean, if it was up to me, you'd put Miralax in the water. I always joke to my patients that, if we put Miralax in the water and stop doing circumcisions, I'd be out of business. because so many of the kids are constipated. And it's hard sometimes for families to recognize that, especially when a child is independent with toileting,
right?
Because you see them, they go to the bathroom or they don't need you to take a look at the poop. And you don't. And when we use the term constipation, I want people to think of it more broadly than just how often you poop, right? So if you poop every day, but it's a rock hard brick that you're dropping, that's constipated, whether you want to think about that, even if it's every day. So it's I like to think of it as the character of the whole experience, right? So if you're having monster sized poops, if you're having hard little pebbles, you're having a thing that looks like a log with cracks in it, that's constipated because the job of your rectum is to suck the water out of the stool. So normally you think of it, and I apologize if this is too graphic, but the way you think about it, the poop comes, the stool comes down, it signals your rectum, then you poop. But if you delay and you hold it, then it sucks the water out of the poop. And that's how you get those hard little balls or those long logs or cracks. And if you delay and delay and delay, you just build up these big, big monster poops. And the problem is, in our society, we reward people for holding it. We reward children for holding their pee because then they're not disrupting us, right? They're not leaving class. They're not having to pull the car over. There's sort of a certain reward for not peeing. And to some degree, there's a reward for not pooping. You know, the kid who has the big hard poops, it's a cleaner wipe. And it's like somehow that's, you know, rewarded. And
it's
so
inconvenient.
It's
you're right. If you're driving somewhere, you're in a rush. We're always in a rush.
You're always in a rush.
To poop or to pull over to pee is an inconvenience. You're right.
Or taking the kids to, you know, strange bathrooms at the mall, or especially if parents are out with a child of the opposite gender. Like I remember, you know, like what age can I stop bringing my daughters into the men's room and I can't walk into the women's room? And I mean, I was a little more fortunate, I think, in some ways, because, you know, if I see a nice woman come in and I say, can you take my daughter with you to go pee? And like, I'd sort of trust that, but there's not that many moms that are going to let some strange guy take their son into the men's room. And so those things, there is this tendency to just encourage people to hold it. And certainly in the schools, they encourage them to hold it. I can't tell you how many times I've had kids who, you know, their issue is their urgency frequency, grabbing their penis, they're having all these issues from, you know, holding it too long.
Right.
And I'm talking to the parent, and the parent's like, you know, I'm a teacher. I have like a couple kids in my class, and now I get it. I actually thought they were just misbehaving. And it's like, it's just, we don't talk about it in our society, and we reward people for holding it. So that's part of the issue. And then the other part of the issue, and you could probably expand on this a lot better than I can, the typical American kid's diet is a horribly constipating diet, right? Heavy meat, heavy processed, you know, carbohydrates, fried food, cheese, lots of dairy.
Not a lot of fruits and vegetables.
Right. If you just look at, you know, the fiber content of a chicken McNugget meal, it's terrible. There's no fiber in there at all. So it's so the kids have a tough time between diet and you know, this encouragement. So they tend to hold it. And so that constipation, you know, the reason the child's grabbing their penis or grabbing their vagina is that they're trying to feel where to tighten up. You know, the way you delay peeing or delay pooping is you tighten up your pelvic muscles.
Right.
It's like doing a Kegel exercise, because Kegel exercises cause relaxation of the bladder. That's really how Kegels work, more so than strengthening the pelvic muscles. They really just relax your bladder. And so that helps you delay. And so it's like, you know, once you start looking for, I remember coaching my kid's soccer game and I see one of the kids on the other team, he's running down the field holding his penis. And so I said to the, I called the referee over. I said, listen, can you tell the other coach 22 needs to go pee?
That's great.
But you see, once you start looking for it, you see it all the time. You see that behavior, squatting, sitting on their heel, squeezing their legs together, grabbing their penis, rubbing against the couch.
Right.
That's a common one. Like, why is my son always rubbing his penis against the couch? And the kids think, the parents sometimes mistaken this for masturbatory behavior, which it's not. It's usually just trying to delay peeing and pooping.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you withhold and you don't go poop when you feel the urge to go, by the time you finally do go, it really will hurt. And then that cycle repeats because they associate pooping with discomfort and then...
No, absolutely true. Absolutely. So you think it's going to hurt, so then it's going to hold it longer.
So let's say most
of the kids with wetting is this, because they hold it too much, not because they can't hold it. But in their brains, they think they're wetting because they can't hold it. They need to hold it better. But it's actually they're wetting because they're holding it too much.
So what is the advice that you would give? Let's say a family comes in to see you. It's a child that started elementary school and they're having a daytime wetting. What's the advice that you would give to a parent? Would you first make sure the child's not constipated? And then where would you
go? So we start with a really detailed discussion of their peeing and pooping habits. And sometimes that can be very difficult, you know, especially, you know, some of the children aren't really able to communicate that well. And as the parents know, you know, the children, they're busy. The parents are children at school. They have other caregivers. So it's oftentimes very hard to know. But if you can convince them we really start with a program of a behavior modification bowel and bladder retraining, right? So it's a form of in a sense, it's like a form of toilet training with more of a modified operant conditioning model.
Okay.
So sort of, so the idea is that you say, listen, we're going to give you a set pee schedule. A normal frequency for peeing is 6 to 8 times a day, which is sometimes a big shock to people, you know, because they'll say like, he pees normally, just like me, twice a day. It's like, okay, that's not normal.
Yeah.
You know, everyone thinks what they do is normal, but it's, you know, 6 to 8 times a day. Now, that sounds like a lot, right? Good. What if I said it this way?
Yes.
You pee when you get up in the morning, recess, lunch, get home from school, before dinner, after dinner, bedtime, 7 times a day. So then it sounds more normal. So we put them on a strict schedule by your peeing by the clock, whether you feel like it or not. So just so your brain learns what normal feels like.
Okay.
We also have them, when they pee, make sure they sit the right way for the girls, or relax. The idea is that peeing is not about pushing hard. So if the girl's sitting with her legs squished together and hunched over and pushing, that's because you're not relaxing your sphincter. So we want their feet on the floor. If it doesn't reach, a phone book or footstool or potty squatty, we have their legs wide apart. And then we want them to lean forward and just think about relaxing your muscles and letting the pee fall out. And then we also have them count to 5, take a deep breath, pee again. So double voiding. And then we have to keep a diary, when you pee, when you poop, when you wet. And then the other thing that's just important is we set a poop time. And a poop time, believe it or not, if you try every day, same time every day, you can train your bowels to go. And then we control the consistency of the stool. And you want it to be soft but firm, like a smooth banana. And we control consistency with a combination of diet, which is really hard to do, and Miralax, which is really easy to do. Now, other people are not a huge fan of Miralax. They like things that are a little more stimulating, like Senecod. Other people like things like flaxseed. I'm a big fan of Miralax. It's a pure softener. It's not a stimulant, so there's no habituation.
And it's easy.
It's odorless, tasteless yeah. powder. Mix in your milk. I mean, I had my middle daughter on it for years, and she's really hypersensitive to taste. She's a redhead. So they oftentimes are super tasters. And even we snuck it past her. So if she would drink it, anybody can drink it. And time voiding, double voiding, voiding diary, time defecation, and Miralax. If they have some element of overactive bladder, so they say, listen, they're peeing 12 times, 15 times a day. How can I make them pee 7 times a day and not hold this? Okay, those are kids we also use medication like anticholinergics, these things like ditropan, to try to slow down their bladder. So this is medicine that relaxes the bladder muscle.
Okay.
If they're having recurrent infections, we also like to use probiotics.
Okay.
And then occasionally there's kids that will even put on prophylactic antibiotics. But for the most part, the other things that we add to that program is Miralax and probiotics. This works 85% of the time.
Okay. So timed voiding, going every 2 to 3 hours mm-hmm. during the day.
Well, no. I should clarify that. Kids don't understand what every 2 to 3 hours means, right? How are you going to get a 6-year-old to understand like what every 2 hours mean? So we base it on their activities.
Okay.
So we say, why don't you pee when you get up in the morning, recess, lunch, get home from school, for dinner, after. Because they understand those activities.
Right.
At preschool set, it's breakfast, snack, lunch, snack, dinner, dessert, bedtime. Because the reason you use those times is those times are the kids eat 6 times a day. Right. So the idea is that you go wash your hands, and they understand about washing their hands. Go potty if you want your snack, if you want your lunch. The idea is that they don't understand time. And what's great about those times, recess later on becomes nutrition. Later on becomes 10 a.m. coffee break. I mean, we have recess our whole life.
Right.
We have breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the same times our whole life. You have that 4 o'clock coffee break. That's get home from school. So the idea is you want to create lifetime changes. If you make them pee every hour, like some kids will get a watch and they'll pee every hour. Like, you can't live like that. What are you going to do when you go to college?
It's too
unnatural. You can't pee every hour.
Right.
So we want to have lifetime behaviors based on activities.
Right.
They don't have watches. Right. You can't really ask the teachers to do it. And so it's got to be, and then you can't really ask them to leave class because that creates all kinds of anxieties. So that's why they have recess. That's why they have lunch. You know, I always tell these kids, you know, recess, you think it's out there so you have 10 minutes of kickball. It's like recess is actually so you can go pee without bothering your teacher. That's the purpose of recess.
Spoken like a true urologist, right? It's true, yeah, how we think about this. I would agree with you. Okay, yeah. So we have, so just to summarize. So voiding during those built-in breaks, going to the bathroom in a relaxed way, counting to five, trying to go again, and then making sure every morning that there's a time when we try to sit down and go poop.
Well, so the poop time, to be honest with you, I actually like for the kids the evening.
Okay.
Because most families will tell you it is too hectic to try to get everyone up and out to school and haven't had time to poop.
Right.
Now, most adults will figure out in their schedule and poop in the morning. So most adults will take like Miralax in the evening and poop in the morning. But for kids, the morning's too hectic for the parent and the kid. We don't want to make it afternoon after school because you don't want to spend the last hour of, you know, math class trying to hold the big poop in. Right. That's not good. And then so we try to make poop in the evening around bath time. That seems to be the time that most kids and parents have a few minutes to just actually relax and have a poop. And there's some kids who really worry about feeling clean. They can poop first and take a bath.
Okay.
Some kids who really need that bath to help them relax can relax and take a poop. And then I give them the Miralax in their morning because their morning glass of milk or juice, whatever they drink, that's the most reliable to get down. And so they'll drink that in the morning and then have them poop in the evening. Because, you know, in the beginning, it's going to take a little time for a kid who's really constipated. It's going to take a little time for the parents to try to, you know, make them really sit there and try long enough to give it a chance. And, you know, so maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, which doesn't seem like a very long time until you're sitting there watching someone try to poop, but then it's an eternity. So what I always tell these families are, listen, you're not there to, you know, sometimes in the beginning, you may need to go in with them just to, you know, the younger children to really reinforce like this is, you know, important, but you got to bring something for yourself.
Right.
If you like crosswords, iPad, golf magazine, whatever you want, bring something for yourself because, and then give yourself a 10 minute break, watch, you know, waiting for them to try to poop because you're not there to entertain them. You're there to reinforce the behavior.
Support them.
But if you're there waiting for like someone to poop, it's going to drive you nuts. So you got to bring something fun for you. And then you just, it's your 10 minute break from the other kids. And then you try to get them to poop and take a bath and go to bed. And if you do this over and over and over again, you can actually get them to poop.
And how long should we expect, like when, let's say we do all these behaviors and we've done it for a week or a month and we don't see an effect. Like after what point would we want to see you?
Yeah. So normally we tell people, listen, behavior modification takes time. You know, I usually don't even see them back again or talk to them again for 8 weeks because it does take time. It does take time. And, you know, and then the question is like, how long do you need to do it for? I say, well, you just do it until when you notice you're not noticing it anymore. That's when you know you can back off. You can just let, but these behaviors are forever.
Right.
So the kids are on medication. Once they notice they're not noticing it, then they can back off on the medication. It is always amazing to me that the thing that brings a lot of the patients to our attention is not the daytime peeing, it's not the sometimes pooping or even poop accidents, it's the bedwetting. Because that's what bothers parents. So I'll have kids with bedwetting, and we always talk about the daytime peeing habit, and they're like, does he have any, they're talking about, it sounds like really constipated. Like, does he have any poop accidents? Like, oh yeah, well, just once or twice a month. I'm like, really? Like, that's not, it's like pooping your pants twice a month's not an issue, but you're worried about bedwetting. So it's really interesting because I think that sometimes the bedwetting really is what is the driver to seek attention.
Sure.
Because we've learned to kind of adapt to these other things. So they're like, oh yeah, we always send him to school with a couple of changes of clothes in his backpack.
That's
and
true.
The kids adapt to it. And, but we like to try to say, no, no, let's address it. And it's, you know, there's no too young to address it because it's easier to change their behavior that, you know, and when, you know, when they're young, you know, you have more control. It's hard is, you know, when you get the little bit older kids and then I have to tell you, I'll even have, you know, junior high school age kids and I'll be honest with them. I'll look right at them and say, listen, when you're little, I just need to talk your mom into this, you know, and mom will work on you. I say, your age, you know, I need to convince you. And I say, older kids either do great or do terrible. Because some of the kids will just look at me like, dude, you don't know anything you're talking about. I'm not doing this. And then nothing happens, right? And then I have some kids like, I get it. You know, they get it. And then they do great.
You make those
and
changes.
They do great. And this works about 85% of the time. And the problem is, you know, the parents are often thinking there's going to be an anatomic issue. Like you're going to find a thorn in their paw and pull it out. It's all going to get better. As opposed to it's a learned pattern of behavior. So I don't mean a conscious behavior. I mean a sort of a, you know, a learned pattern of how their brain and bladder are communicating. And we need to change that and reset that thermostat in a sense. You know, the way, the analogy I'm using now, so we know scientifically in a sense that, listen, your bladder does feel stretched, right? Because parents always say, oh, they don't feel it. But your bladder is continually signaling its state of stretch to your brain. But that center of your brain is also getting inputs from all over your brain, right? It's getting inputs from what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, your emotions, all over your brain is going to this one center, which then sort of has the final processing of saying like, go, no, go, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, this is a good time to pee, let's do it. Or this is a bad time to pee, let's try to hold it. And then it suppresses your brain, tightens your sphincter, or vice versa. And so when we say they don't feel it, it's a question of whether they're recognizing it and making that decision. And so if you leave, if you take normal kids, let them run around, and you measure every time they pee, how much they pee, and how much is left in their bladder after they pee, kids will pee at 10% of the bladder capacity to 90% of the bladder capacity, depending on what else is going on, right? So like, if you're getting ready to get in the car, you might feel like you need to go pee if you only have 10% of your bladder, right? Because if it's a long car ride, you're thinking about it. Last time you went there, you had to hold it. You made you uncomfortable. Like all those things are processing in your brain without you realizing it consciously. Right. The analogy I use is think about when you're driving your car and that idiot light goes on saying, you know, your gas tank's getting low. You got 30 miles, right? Well, you don't immediately pull over and get gas. Right, you sort of think about it, like, well, what am I doing this evening? Where am I? Am I on the freeway? You know, where am I going? How much time do I have? Is maybe tomorrow's better? Or I have my favorite gas station on the way to work. I'll do that tomorrow. You know, whatever it is, you make the decision. You have the same information, and you might make a totally different decision based on all those other factors.
Right.
Well, that's what it's like for peeing and pooping, or more so, you know, particularly peeing. And so when they say they can't feel it, it's just that we need to change that thermostat. We need to get to the point where their brain recognizes what normal fullness feels like, a normal interval for peeing should feel like, and like when is a good time to pee. And that's why we try to create these habits.
I think that's great. Really, really helpful, useful advice. I often say too, the bladder is like, it's like a scrunchie or rubber band. If it gets too stretched or you hold things for too long, it gets floppier, it doesn't work as well. And so you have to retrain it to get that muscle back into shape just to make sure you frequently void and use the restroom.
Yeah.
Okay. So can we transition? You touched on, peeing at nighttime or nocturnal enuresis, as we call it.
Okay.
This comes up a lot. We'll have a kid that's great at, using the toilet during the day. But when it comes mm-hmm. to the nighttime, they're still in a diaper, you know, well into elementary school. How do you still think about that in the same way that you think about the daytime dysfunctional voiders, or what advice do you give for the nighttime bedwetters?
Okay. So, when we talk about the bedwetters, first, I want to reassure everybody, bedwetting is really, really common. Okay. It's really common. So 20% of kids 4 to 5 years old wet the bed. Decrease about 10% per year down to about 1% by age 16. We try to get cool people's jets before age, you know, at least age 6. But that's sort of a, you know, rough rule of thumb. But when we think about bedwetting, we break them up into 4 different groups.
Okay.
Right? So those kids who always wet, like never had a long period of dryness, versus those kids who were dry for, say, 6 months or a year and then started wetting again. And the second way to break it up is those kids are perfect during the daytime, but only wet when their brain's asleep, which could be naps too, versus those kids who wet, you know, have issues daytime and nighttime. So when you're thinking about bedwetting and all, you're reading articles about bedwetting, you're reading in the popular press about bedwetting or reading, you know, about techniques for bedwetting, that's referring to the kids who've always wet, primary, who are perfect during the day, but only wet when the brain's asleep, or monosymptomatic bedwet, enuretic. So that group is, that's the classic bedwetting group. And so for that group, we approach it a little bit differently. So the kids who have the daytime issues, we want to address their daytime issues because you're not going to make traction on the nighttime until you fix the daytime.
Okay.
And when you fix the daytime, a lot of times the nighttime gets better, right? And oftentimes those kids will have had a period of dryness, but then as their daytime function got worse, then they started wetting at night. So that's a totally different group. So, but for your classic bedwetting, the kid that comes in who's, you know, 7, 8 years old, 9 years old, maybe it, you know, their family is anxious about it, then those are the kids that we think about bedwetting. And the way I'd have you think about it is, you know, there's probably lots of different reasons why kids wet the bed. It's probably not a single condition. So the model that we use, this imperfect model, is like a balancing act, right? One hand, how much urine you make, right? Versus how much your bladder will hold when your brain's asleep, and the tipping point being the sort of concept of arousability. So I mean by that, some kids just make too much, right? Because they either don't like to drink a day, because they don't like to pee at school, and then they do all the drinking in the evening, and then they make too much. Because, you know, you sort of might need to drink every day. The other is that there are some kids who probably have there's a hormone that when you sleep, your body knows you're going through a fasting state. So there's a hormone that goes to your kidney and tells you to save water. We're fasting. We're not going to be eating for, you know, 10 hours. Save water.
ADHD. And that they,
yeah, exactly. And that for some people, that system may not be perfect. The other group is the bladder doesn't hold as well. Those are the daytime issues. But the arousability issues, again, there's kids who's probably related to the depth of sleep, that when they sleep so deeply, their brain and the bladder disconnect. And then the bladder does what things are supposed to do, which is fill and empty.
That's probably what I hear the most, is that parents will say they're just such heavy sleepers.
Yeah, it's absolutely been studied, and they are. They put headphones on these kids, played 120 decibels. It's like being in the Seahawks stadium, you know, in the football game, and they don't wake up. It has been shown. But so there really is basically four layers of treatment options for these kids. So the first thing you want to find out is you don't have to do anything. Bedwetting is not dangerous. It's not harmful. It's a social disease. So one of the things we actually do, we ask the kid, and we make sure we understand that we're asking the child alone, how much does this bother you? Because if it doesn't bother them, you don't have to necessarily treat it.
I love that.
And, you know, yeah, well, you know, because it really is a social issue. Now, you know, obviously, if it bothers the parents enough, it'll bother the kid. But, you know, it comes up more of an issue with sleepovers and camps. And I have to admit, I think during the pandemic, our bedwetting referrals went way down.
Oh, really?
Because no one's going over to sleepovers. Yeah. No one's going to sleep over a camp in a year and a half. The next level up is there are some behaviors that can help. This can help everybody. So these are pushing fluids early in the daytime, shifting that fluid cycle. So you're making less at night. You know, I tell these families, like, drink two glasses at breakfast, a glass at recess, two glasses at lunch, glass when you get home from, you know, from school, maybe half a glass at dinner time, and cut them off 2-3 hours before bedtime. Avoid things that are bladder irritants, caffeine, carbonation, citrus. Parents don't think that they give the kids caffeine, but, you know, if you drink chocolate milk, that's got caffeine in it, right?
Good point.
So we try to push, you know, and, you know, a lot of these teas and sports drinks have other kinds of stimulants or bladder irritants. And then obviously PB for go to bed. That does help some kids, especially the kids who's down to like once a week or twice a week. And then the next level up is the bed alarm. And I'm sure you've recommended a bed alarm for many of your patients.
Yes.
The bed alarm does work. It works about 70% for people who stick with it. You got to plan on sticking with it up to 12 weeks before you give up. A third of families drop out in the first 2 weeks. That's the downside of bed alarm.
Yeah, they're not doing it after the first 2 weeks?
Because they don't like it. They don't like to be woken up. They don't like the kids don't like to be woken up.
Yes.
And they have to understand the bed alarm doesn't stop you from wetting. It goes off after you wet, and then your brain learns to anticipate that and associate that sense of bladder fullness with the waking up, and then suppresses your bladder.
And I know they say to give it 12 weeks, but I've actually had a number of families, just to give anyone listening hope out there, mm-hmm. I've had a number of families where 3 days in and the kids much improved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it does seem to help with that communication between the brain and the bladder, and it does seem to work. But I just think that before you call it a fail, you want to give it enough time.
And do you have a preference between the alarm or the vibration? Because there's two types I know that are popular.
Yeah, I would say that whatever works for you. I actually tell the family a lot of times, try it out ahead of time with, like, if you have an old-fashioned pager or you have your cell phone, you know, vibrates, you stick it on them when they're asleep and see if they wake up to alarm. So some kids do wake up better to the vibration. I think the vibration is also good if the child's sharing a room with another child.
True.
So you're not waking up everybody.
True.
But otherwise, whatever works for them, and a lot of the devices will have both modes, and so that's fine.
I like that intervention too, because it's not, there's no medication involved. It's really a harmless intervention. Yeah.
And you don't have to spend a lot. So, you know, so
$40, I see some.
They range quite a bit, but you'll sometimes see, all right, I'm going to go out on a limb here. So sometimes you'll see that there's these bedwetting services, and they guarantee you in 2 years, they guarantee your child will stop bedwetting. And what they are is they're a bed alarm and a cheerleader. So what it is they give you a bed alarm, And then they call you, they have a nurse who calls you every couple of days to see how you're doing and pushes you to keep doing it, and then have you send your cards in. You know, you realize, you know, 30-40% of the kids have gotten better just in the 2 years.
Right.
You know? And then, and but all they're doing is really improving your compliance, but they charge a fortune. Mm. I mean, people are paying thousands of dollars for these services, which you really could just do yourself with $90 bed alarm.
Right.
So I would just say, you know, any reasonable bed alarm, there's, you know, bedwettingstore.com or some other, you know, Potty MD. There's a number of these, you know, you don't need a prescription. And I would just buy a reasonable, cheap one. And it's just really up to you to be the cheerleader. You don't need to pay thousands of thousands of dollars to have someone call you every day.
No. No, I always tell parents just to peruse Amazon, look up bedwetting alarms, and they'll see all the options and read the reviews.
Yeah. And then the last option is medication. And medication does help. That's DDAVP. I don't use Tofranil. DDAVP is very safe. We tend to use it in a little bit older children. It tends to work better in older children who are wet late in the sleep period. So these are the kids where the parents will say, listen, if I wake him up at midnight and he pees and he's still dry, then he'll be dry the next day, you know, but I can't wake him up at camp. Well, then those kids have a high likelihood of working well with DDAVP, which primarily we think works by reducing the volume of urine you make that night. Mm. We take it an hour before bed, but we do encourage the families to restrict fluids that evening because you don't want to overwhelm it. And it should be very safe. And people don't have to use it every day if they're fine at home, but they have nights that they really need to be dry, right? So we have kids who, you know, every weekend they spend with grandma and grandma can't deal with it. You know, like, okay, you just use it for those nights.
Situational.
Or camp, or a lot of these kids out on these travel sports teams, you know, every weekend they're, you know, somewhere else and, you know, their parent can't always go with them. So it can be very helpful, for those situations,
for short
as opposed to taking it every night.
For like a short-term event, like a sleepover or something where you...
Right, sleepover. Because if it works for you, it tends to be very reliable and work every time, you know, work continuously. And you also have the advantage of you don't wet as often when you sleep outside the home. You know, because you don't sleep as well. We all have predator threat, right? So we all have predator threat where, you know, you change your, this is why you don't sleep that well in the first night at a hotel. You know, you just always, you're outside of your cave. And it's actually very frustrating for a lot of families where the kids spend their time between two different parents. Because one parent will say, how come he wets at my house? He doesn't wet at dad's house. Like, well, because your house is his cave. That house is, you know, the other kid's the other cave.
I like that. The predator threat. Now I make more sense to myself why I don't sleep as well outside of the house.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, we're not that far removed from our caveman days.
Explains a lot. Okay, so the four things, just to summarize, you said are to either do nothing. This is for kids that have nighttime wetness, either to do nothing, let time take its course, push fluids early on in the day, and restrict fluids before you go to bed, 2-3 hours if possible. The third thing is to try the bedwetting alarms. Mm-hmm. And then the last is, if there are certain situations where it might be helpful, we could try DDAVP or medication.
Right.
Okay. Right. Did I miss anything?
Oh, with the behaviors, we also have them avoid bladder irritants and always make sure they go to pee.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that's hard, and I tell the families this, is you have a lot of kids who play sports where they actually have practices fairly late in the evening. And they're like, well, what am I going to do? We have soccer practice at 7 o'clock. Coach makes us drink a liter of fluid. We're running around. I say, you know, just accept you're going to be wet those nights. You know, just realize like that's a night I'm going to be wet. And so it's okay, you know, to have that, you know, because if you can't always, you know, follow the directions.
This has been great. This is so helpful. I think
terrific.
There's so many families that bring up these issues and they're embarrassed, I think, to talk about it outside of the doctor's office. So this is really, really helpful.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because there's no reason bedwetting should have a stigma. It's not, I mean, I tell the kids, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's not your fault. I mean, there's nothing you're doing. It's not conscious. It's just how your brain is maturing. You will outgrow this. You know, it doesn't take away from being a great kid. And a lot of times I'll ask families if there's any other wetters in the family. Because these things run in families.
Yes.
And sometimes no one's ever told the kid, like, oh, by the way, your dad wet the bed or your uncle wet the bed. And they're like, Uncle Joey, he's a great guy. You know, it makes the kid feel better.
Right. Because, he's doing it now.
Right. And so we really want to try to suppress that stigma, because there's no reason why does that have a stigma?
Yes.
You know? And so it's right. We wouldn't stigmatize people for, I don't know, you know, having a limp. I don't know. I can't think of a good analogy at the moment, but you know what I mean?
No, so it's just,
we really do want to try to break down that stigma, and it's helpful for the, you know, the families not to get frustrated, not to think that it's due to their parenting. And right. The biggest problem is, if you look at the popular literature, okay, like Chris Rock and Sarah Silverman and some other people, they talk about bedwetting in a way that it was related to the psychological stressors that they were going through as a child. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't kids for whom psychological stress isn't a contributor, but we worry about those kids in the secondary wetters. So these are kids who are wet, dry for a period of time, and then start wetting. You know, and that's when you worry about the classic triggers like divorce, new child, you know, family loss of, you know, finances or incarceration or, you know, those kinds of, you know, but those are not like subtle things. Usually you can pick up that history, but I worry about, I usually seek that history in the secondary wetters. But unfortunately, if you only listen, you know, like Chris Rock has a whole riff on this about him being a bedwetter, but he makes it sound like it was all just psychological. And I'm like, no, Chris, you know, you're stigmatizing all these kids. Don't do it.
Making fun of himself, but probably in a way that we're more sensitive
in a way to her. Right. Just like when people talk about other, you know, people being nervous, or they call them a bedwetter. You know, it's like, oh, let's not use that terminology, guys. Let's think of something else. Because we really wanted to reduce the stigma, because there's no reason to have a stigma.
I think also parents, you're right. I think kids, it's helpful for kids to make them feel like it's normal because they're not doing it on purpose. And then I also think it's good to remind parents, I'll often meet parents, they'll compare one sibling to the next. They'll say, well, I feel so bad because my daughter who's 3 is already potty trained and my son who's 5 is still wetting. And so I think comparison makes things tricky for parents. So the more I think this is great just to emphasize how normal it can be and they're not doing it on purpose. Okay. So this has been fantastic. I so appreciate your time. Are there any last minute tips of advice that you want to throw out there? Anything I missed that we didn't talk about?
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, a couple things. I mean, first of all, I really appreciate you willing to talk about pediatric urology, because you know we don't talk about it a lot. You never in 10 years of ER, you never saw a good urology story, you know, watching it on TV. So I really appreciate the chance to bring it up, because these are things that happens all the time.
Thank you.
I also tell people that, listen, you know, it's always you should feel comfortable bringing up these issues with your pediatricians, because the pediatricians really do know a lot about these issues and are a great resource to start with. So don't be embarrassed to bring it up or feel like you can only talk to the specialist, and that we're here for you. There's lots of us in town and they're all over the country, and we're here for you if you have concerns. And a lot of times we just provide reassurance, but sometimes that can be helpful. So we're always happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all your time. You're really wonderful.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Lucky to know you. Thanks for taking care of all our patients too that I send you. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Appreciate your confidence.
Thank you so much to Dr. Andrew Friedman for being on the podcast Ask Dr. Jessica this week. Be sure and stay tuned. We're going to have him back again, and we're going to continue this discussion. Thank you.